"Call us," I sharply ordered, then turned away. George quickly joined me as we cleared the area. He had heard the entire encounter. By now, we'd worked together for a couple of years. With him, I'd always been polite and courteous. He had never seen me brace a target like that.
"What the fuck? Let's get out of here," George said.
In the car, George looked at me, shook his head, and started laughing.
"I think he shit himself."
"Maybe."
"Will he report the pitch? Or will he call you guys?"
George asked.
"Don't know. He's probably too scared to tell anybody about this and too scared to work with us. But he's got something to think about."
Later that week, during one of our private sessions, I informed the U.S. ambassador about the pitch. I was not required to, given the low chance of any political fallout, but doing so provided him with a good example of our liaison work, part of the larger U.S. government relationship. During my tour, there were a couple of operations that warranted prior notification of the ambassador because of the sensitivity to the host government or the grave risk to our officers. Our embassy was blessed with a great ambassador who became a great friend. I told him more than required, and perhaps more than he wanted, but his guidance and support were superb. CIA operations fall into a larger political context, although sometimes CIA officers forget this. Intelligence serves a political purpose and supports policymakers and implementers. Our station was fortunate because our ambassador understood and respected our work and used our product. This was not always the case. The CIA leads a massive, expanding network of foreign liaison relationships with almost every country in the world. Although the clandestine service places an emphasis, as it should, on unilateral sources, these liaison programs are increasingly essential given the rise of complex transnational threats. This expansion of liaison is driven primarily by the growth of sophisticated global enemies posing more and more complex dangers. Terrorism, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, narco-crime, human trafficking, and even environmental risks bring unique challenges to intelligence services. No single intelligence service can tackle all this. Given its global presence, power, and depth of relationships, the CIA has assumed a leading role. Through its ability to collect, analyze, and coordinate responses with multiple services in real time across the global landscape, the CIA provides a valuable service as an integrator, de facto coordinator, and sometimes leader. But of course, such relationships are not just about cooperation. There is also competition, most acute in the efforts of intelligence services to penetrate each other. The CIA is no exception. To gauge counterintelligence risks, the CIA must understand the plans and intentions of other services, and the best means to do so is via unilateral sources within those services. How and when such an effort is taken obviously requires careful calculation of risk and reward. Of even greater consequence, what does the United States gain or lose in power, including the power of natural virtue, by engaging in these liaison relationships? Although these relationships are approved and often directed by U.S. policymakers, how would the CIA fare when international political winds shifted? Would the United States' reputation be enhanced or degraded? No mission would teach me more about the importance of liaison than counterterrorism. Chapter 6. Counterterrorism. There is a tendency in our planning to confuse the unfamiliar with the improbable. Thomas Schelling, Harvard economist, in reference to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. In spring 1998, HQS directed me to return from overseas to serve on a promotion panel that would evaluate and recommend GS-15 officers for promotion to the Senior Intelligence Service, SIS, ranks. It was a big jump for these officers, from the military equivalent of a colonel to a brigadier general. I had been promoted into the SIS ranks the previous year and understood how important the panel would be, not just for the officers, but, more important, for the future of the clandestine service and the security of our nation. Those promoted would join a very small group of leaders responsible for America's espionage and covert action. The panel lasted more than a month. We read scores of files. Only 6 officers would be promoted. The panel for me was an education, not only about the officers, but also about the clandestine service itself. The service's reach and performance amazed me, even though I had worked a variety of undercover operations in countries throughout Africa, Europe, and Asia. The risk and complexity of the operations, from deep commercial cover inside the world's most dangerous regimes to covert influence at the highest levels of foreign governments, were displayed in these files spread before us. Some of the operations were so sensitive that there were no written records in the officer's personnel file, only notations for the panel to request oral briefings. The officers under review had collected intelligence and engaged in covert action against nation-states, narco-traffickers, weapons smugglers, terrorists, and even targets we did not know were on the target list. Our panel examined the sources recruited and the quality of intelligence gathered by these officers or those under their command. We sought to determine the impact of their nation-states, narco-traffickers, weapons smugglers, terrorists, and even targets we did not know were on the target list. Our panel examined the sources recruited and the quality of intelligence gathered by these officers or those under their command. We sought to determine the impact of their work and the value of their leadership. At the GS-15 rank, they were engaged in interagency cooperation and, of course, bureaucratic disputes. The work of these officers spoke to the complex overlay of intelligence with military operations, law enforcement, and diplomacy. Their ability to navigate interagency minefields was an important part of our review. The skills required to work with foreign liaison services were another. The top 10% of officers was obvious. About 70% fell in the very good to mediocre group. The bottom 20% should never have been promoted to GS-15. Of those, maybe half had no business in the CIA. We made our recommendations to the Deputy Director of Operations, DDO, James Pavitt, who agreed with most of our findings but dropped a couple to make room for 2 of his favorites. I disagreed with his choices, but it was his prerogative. Pavitt asked me to visit him in his 7th-floor office where Director Tenet and the other deputy directors worked. We often referred to the CIA leadership simply as the 7th floor. I wondered if Pavitt wanted to discuss our work on the promotion panel or my next assignment. I had requested an extension of my current field assignment, but had been rejected. After 14 of the last 16 years working undercover in the foreign field, it was my time to return to HQS. As usual, Pavitt offered a hearty greeting. He did not stay behind his desk, but moved to a table where I joined him. His office was big enough for the extra table and a couch, but not much more. Always sporting fine clothes with bold colored ties, Pavitt seemed to enjoy his status. He had learned the Washington, D.C. environment. In his prior job, he'd been chief of the Counterproliferation Division based in HQS. Before that, he'd been detailed to the National Security Council. His last position abroad was COS of a small European station. He fidgeted with his big rings and his big fountain pen while asking me about the panel and about my professional aspirations. I told him that I was keen to try something different, broaden my horizons. I told him that I was even interested in going back to school for a year or two. "What about an assignment to FBI HQS? You would be deputy in their International Terrorism Operations section, with line authority. You would replace Jeff." Knowing almost nothing about the position, but knowing the importance of the counterterrorism mission, I responded, "I'll take it. Thanks for the opportunity." "Good. We will make it happen." I walked out of the office wondering if my snap decision was a good one. I surmised that Jeff probably had endorsed me. I later learned that Jeff had, in fact, recommended me as his replacement. That was a plus. I also learned that Pavitt and others thought I was a good fit because, as one confidant said, the CIA leadership considered me a lunch pail guy. In other words, I would get along with the blue-collar FBI special agents. Well, I figured they got that right. There was a stream of recent CIA intelligence reporting on Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. The CIA had disrupted several AQ plots, in one case preventing an attack on a U.S. government facility. The enemy's threats and operations, however, continued to expand. Just a couple